Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Doug. Just a little housekeeping here. Everything I say is a personal opinion. Now I can say anything I damn well please, because I just let you off the hook. Not important to anybody else, but it impresses the hell out of me. I've been sober 7,596 days today, one day at a time, by the simple expedient of not taking the first drink. And that's from today back to January 16th, 1976. I'm real disappointed that your theme is back to basics. Because I really had planned to talk on the relationship dynamics of bisexual codependent adult children of dysfunctional neurotics negotiating a relationship according to principles of recovery from dual addiction. But I don't think Steve wants to hear that, so I'll just have to tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And the long and the short of that is I used to be a self-loathing drunk. What happened was I took the steps, and today I'm self-respecting and sober. And that's about it. I'm going to talk for an hour or so because it's my story. And I think it's highly entertaining. But if you decide otherwise, you just got the message. So, you can leave now. January 29th, 1949, in the city of Ravenna in Portage County, Ohio, a doctor named Neely severed the umbilical cord which connected me to my prenatal environment, and I began 13 years of uninterrupted sterling sobriety. Then I had a slip. And my first drink came in the parking lot of a bowling alley in Harris County, Texas, in about mid-August. I was standing out there in one of these asphalt parking lots with two or three other misfits, and we had a bottle of Gallo Paisano. And for those of you who, like I do, still read labels, Ernest and Julio have gone sort of upscale on us. And they now make expensive or moderate-priced white wines for people who snort white powder. But when I started drinking, they still made Paisana, which, according to its label, was the favorite table wine of Italian America. And I could agree with that because at 99 cents a quart, price alone would endear it to anybody whether they were Italian or not. And it also suggested that it could be served chilled or at room temperature. And room temperature in the parking lot of a bowling alley in Harris County, Texas in mid-August is about 96 degrees Fahrenheit. So I can't tell you that my first drink went down smooth. Because it didn't. It came back up smooth. And I had to catch my breath and, got stuck in my nose and I had to sort of force it down. It wasn't glamorous from the beginning, but when that stuff hit bottom, I had a spiritual awakening. And I honestly think that I spent the rest of my adult life trying to recover that feeling of well-being that I had only on my first drunk. I had a sense of being cute and smart and sexy and witty and 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and besides that, hell, I could bowl. And from that point on, I kept trying to get back to that level of well-being that I believe I experienced only on my first drunk, and I never got quite all the way back. But there was something about a can of Schlitz that erased the memory of the last can of Schlitz, not completely, but enough to make the next can of Schlitz seem like the best idea in the whole world. And it was always the next drink that was going to get me back to that plateau of wellness that I was seeking to recover. It never quite got me there. If I'd ever hit the magic drink, I wouldn't have needed the next one to get there. By January 16th of 1976, I'd run through all of the glamorous drinking, and I'd somehow managed to obtain a license from the state of Texas to practice law before any court of that jurisdiction. And that ought to tell you more about the standards of the state of Texas than about any other significant factor. But I was attempting to practice my profession in a blackout. And I know there are Al-Anons here because you had an Al-Anon meeting about 2 o'clock this afternoon. And there are probably some other non-alcoholics who don't really know what a blackout is. And the only way I know to explain it to a non-alcoholic is to say that it is as if your brain came back from vacation and did not know what your body had been doing while it was gone. And on this occasion, my brain came back from vacation to find my body sitting in a court of law and staring intently at a criminal complaint. And there was good news and bad news about the situation. The good news is I'm not the defendant. Bad news is I don't know who is. And the prosecutor in this case was a friend of mine. His name is Herb G. He's not anonymous. He's Chinese. And Herb came over to me and said, "Doug, you're drunk." And I said, "No shit." Which, for those of you who don't approve of vulgarity from this podium, is Latin for no shit. And so he said, "Is your client here?" And I said, "I don't know." See, I hadn't quit drinking yet, and miracles are already happening. I'm starting to get honest. So he called out a name, and some fool raised his hand in the back of the room, and Herb turned around and said, "I'm going to dismiss this case on one condition." And I said, "You got it. What is it?" And he said, "You have your client drive you home." So I don't know how you began to realize that your life had become unmanageable, but one of my first hints was that the sovereign authority of the state of Texas thought that some screwball who was accused of speeding through a school zone was much more to be trusted with a motor vehicle than I was. And so we went out in the hall, and I got introduced to my client, and I had him take me to my office. I wasn't going to go home because my wife lived there. And she was on my list of people who were not supposed to suspect that I had a drinking problem. And I've looked back on that situation and realized that by that point in my career, I had become a chronic bedwetter. And moreover, I generally wet her side of the bed. And then I'd roll over and go to sleep. And I thought this lovely lady who was getting regularly urinated upon didn't know that I had a drinking problem. Thanks to the treatment industry, we now know that that's called violating boundaries. In my first marriage, that was just our version of sleeping on the wet spot. But I went back to my office, which was 9x12, plumbing and wiring below standard, had a gravel parking lot, way below my standards, of course, but conveniently located 50 feet from a beer joint. And I had this experience that I know was metaphysically and physically and chemically and biologically impossible because I was too drunk to walk. I was 50 feet from a beer joint, and being a professional man, I could run a tab at the beer joint. So I didn't even need money to get a drink. I needed to be able to get up from behind my desk and walk down the hall, out the door, and across the parking lot. And I was stricken by a condition of alcoholic paralysis, which meant that I couldn't get up from behind my desk. And my landlord went next door and got me a drink. I'm not a doctor of medicine, but I assume that if you're too drunk to walk, the probability is extremely high that you're too drunk to think. And yet I was allowed to think for a few minutes, honestly and concisely, about the one subject that a drinking alcoholic dares never to consider, which was my own drinking. And I was allowed to see that the things that I had used as excuses for drinking were problems that had been caused or compounded by my drinking. And I'm convinced that if you're too drunk to walk, you're also too drunk to think, and that if you have a disease which is characterized by denial, even when you can think, that's the one subject you don't dare approach. So the fact that I was allowed to think about my drinking and come to an accurate conclusion about it is beyond the possibility of all the medical and psychological theory that I'm familiar with, and I can only attribute that to a power greater than myself. And the next most surprising thing is that I took appropriate action under the circumstances. I somehow knew that I needed a spiritual solution. And I didn't want to come to AA because the only thing I knew about you was that you couldn't drink. And I'd earnestly and honestly hoped I never got that bad. I knew three categories of non-drinkers. They were Christian Scientists, Southern Baptists, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And as far as I was concerned, they were interchangeable and undesirable. And so I called my pastor, and in my mind's eye, I was going to go out to the pastor's house, and we were going to have a word of prayer, and I was going to have a charismatic experience from which I would emerge a normal social drinker. And I got double-crossed by a man of the cloth, because he turned me into AA. You know, and that really wasn't what I bargained for. So I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to acquire some information. One of the most important things I learned was that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I'm truly glad that that has become, you know, not only that first part of the fifth chapter has changed, the original version of the third tradition required an honest desire to stop drinking. So they found out they wasn't drunk, but they had an honest desire to stop drinking. So they had to disqualify the qualification. And I had a highly qualified desire to stop drinking. I wanted to stop drinking for 30 days. But I figured I needed help just to do that. And in the course of that 30 days, I got a better idea. I thought I'd stay sober for 6 months and get out of debt. At the end of the 6 months, I had acquired some credit, and I was deeper in debt than I had been when I quit drinking. But I had also found out that I had a disease which is progressive and terminal. And what that really means is it always gets worse, never better, and it finally kills you. And I was grateful for that information because when I got serious about the disease, I got serious about the recovery. When sobriety became a matter of life and death, the steps took on a much greater interest than they had previously had. And I began to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to get involved in this process called sponsorship. And it was the beginning for me of a process of recovery, which is a relative thing. I'm also living proof that you don't have to recover to stay sober a long time. You know, if you just don't take the first drink one day at a time, you can die divorced, bankrupt, disgraced, and under indictment. But somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous will come to your funeral and say, there was a winner. On the other hand, if you meet all of society's expectations and go back to drinking, you know, people down the AA club will say, I always knew he was full of shit. Never had any recovery, you know. So I got into AA and I found out that I had this disease which was progressive and terminal, and then I found out something else. I found out that you had a solution. And you had a solution that was unconditional and that you didn't soft sell or downplay, and it was based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't believe that the basics have changed. I don't believe that the fundamentals of this program are any different today than they were for me in 1976. Or in fact than they were for Bill and Dr. Bob in 1935. But I do believe that over the course of events like other human societies, We get these little viruses or emotional enthusiasms, and we don't have any natural immunities to those viruses. So they run through the fellowship and we catch them. And if they're not terminal, if we don't die from them, we recover from them. And when we recover from them, we come back. And when we come back, we come back to basics. The first virus that I survived was, and some of you probably weren't even born yet. In 1976, the RAND Corporation commissioned a study which proved that alcoholics could successfully become normal social drinkers. And they, some of them tried. It wasn't until about 12 years later that Newsweek magazine reported that they finally did a follow-up on those RAND Corporation experimental alcoholics, and Newsweek called the results horrific, which is just a wonderful word for most of them are dead and the rest are sicker than dogs. anybody remember transactional analysis? Transactional analysis was popular before the dysfunctional family. Transactional analysis held to the theory that we all have an inner parent, an inner adult, and an inner child, and that we communicate on the level of parent to child, or child to adult, or child to child, or parent to parent. And then we communicate with ourselves on the level of parent to child, and we got to get to the adult. And if my adult talks to your adult, then you and I are adults, and we don't get drunk. But not only that, there was a guy who wrote a book called Games Alcoholics Play, which showed all the diagrams of all the transactions analyzed, which is why they called it transactional analysis. And his last chapter suggested that if my adult talks to your adult, I can drink. And then we got the inner child. This is hot stuff. A friend of mine in Houston came up with this after he got, you know, he wrote a book about toxic shame. When people stopped buying it, he wrote another book about the inner child. And he's about due for another book. But when I came in, there was a guy named Harry M. Thibault, who was a psychiatrist who had worked with Bill and Bob and the old-timers, who wrote a book called His Majesty the Baby. And the theory of His Majesty the Baby is that we all have this two-year-old that was running the show. And if we wanted to be sober and responsible, we had to kill him. By the time I found out I was supposed to nurture my inner child, I had already throttled the little bastard on Dr. Thibault's advice. A hot topic, by the way, for today. I think we sort of survived this one, too, but to a degree we're still in it. I go to meetings where I feel like I'm an unwanted minority. And I go to meetings where I feel like I'm an unwanted minority because I can't identify. I was in the mild hallucinogen generation, if you will. And unlike the president and like Dwayne that spoke this morning, I did inhale. I just didn't like the results. And I had a spiritual experience. I'm glad they changed that word, spiritual experience, to spiritual awakening, because I had a spiritual experience in college, and it came as a result of dropping acid. And it didn't change my attitude and outlook on life, and it certainly had no impact on my behavior. But I got here just old enough not to consider myself an addict and an alcoholic. And I came from one of those families that was just healthy enough that I can't really call it dysfunctional. And I don't remember any incidents of childhood abuse, sexual, emotional, physical, or otherwise. And I go to meetings these days and I feel like an unwanted stepchild because people say, well, I'm the dysfunctional son of neurotic, alcoholic, cross-addicted parents, and, well, I've decided that I am an alcoholic and a circumcised male. You know, if you got to have two problems, those are mine. And in all honesty, my circumcision doesn't bother me a bit today. But I figure it must have been traumatic at the time. But I think if we survived the RAND Corporation, we survived transactional analysis, we survived the nurture of the inner child, we'll probably survive the dual problem obsession. If we don't take the first drink and continue to work with others on the basis of the third tradition, the fifth tradition, I will talk about the traditions before I sit down because they're important to me and I consider they're part of the basics. But when I tell my story, I don't really tell you about my drinking because I don't remember most of it. And I can't tell you a lot about my recovery because it hasn't happened yet. I can just sort of tell you what I do on a daily basis to say stay sober and what I did when I got here to get sober. And it really goes back to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the principles, in the last year and a half or 2 years, I've been on a sort of a revival of the Four Absolutes binge. And I'll probably survive that virus, as well as the others. That's my current enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've rediscovered the Four Absolutes. As a result of doing everything wrong, I got back to doing some things right. When I came in, they said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, and what in the hell is that supposed to mean? It did not make sense to me, and what I've discovered for myself is that step one actually describes two aspects of a threefold disease. That's the physical and mental aspect of my physical, mental, and spiritual illness, which is identified as alcoholism. I'm powerless over alcohol, that means I can't take it. No problem, don't take it. My life is unmanageable because my body that can't take it is governed by a mind that can't leave it alone. And now I got a problem. Because when you live in a body that can't take it, governed by a mind that can't leave it alone, where are you going to go from there? And the answer, as best I can tell, is you've got to get your mind fixed. Which presented me with step two and the insulting suggestion that I was actually insane. Step two suggests that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I've wondered about the use of the word restore. I had no emotional or mental condition before my first drink which would qualify as sanity. And in fact, that's why I drank. And therefore, there was no mental or emotional condition before my first drink to which I would like to be restored, thank you very much. Except for the ultimate simplicity of sobriety itself. And that's the one point upon which both the medical community and the general community that knew me and my personal reality would agree. The only sanity to which I can be restored is the simple sanity of abstinence from alcohol. Anything else is not a restoration, it's a free gift that goes beyond anything I had before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what step two is really telling me, and I believe insanity for our purposes, has to do with the simple insanity of the first drink. I never planned the things I did, but the first drink intervened. I never consciously said, I had a hard day at work today, I need to relax, I think I'll go out and sideswipe some parked cars. Just what happened, I never said, hey, the Oilers won, let's celebrate, let's go home and start a fight. And I never really said, it's a holiday, what are you going to do the 4th of July weekend? I think I'll go out and get arrested. Didn't plan those things, they just happened. And the intervening circumstance was the insanity of the first drink. And so for me, step two suggests simply that I need a power greater than myself to restore me to the sanity of sobriety. Anything beyond that is not a restoration. It's a free gift that goes beyond anything I had before I got here. The other thing is, I believe that puts the focus back on the we, which is the first word of the first step and carries throughout the 12 steps. The only common sanity that we ever had was abstinence from alcohol. Some of us have had other conditions that qualify as sanity. Some of us just never been there before. But we, at some point in our lives, were teetotalers. And we can be restored to that condition of sanity through the intervention of a higher power. So, step three suggested that we made a decision, novel thought, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And this opens up a marvelous can of worms in terms of who is God and what's that decision. And it's interesting to me that there was a fellow, when they wrote the big book, just to touch on a historical point, and I'm not going to say this by way of intending any offense to anyone, but the higher power of the Oxford groups was unquestionably and unqualifiedly Jesus Christ. In fact, the Oxford groups were a somewhat evangelical movement, and Bill and Dr. Bob had been exposed to the Oxford groups before they got here. They had a fellow named Jim Burwell, who was an agnostic, and he did make a contribution to the big book. They let him insert the phrase, God as we understood him. And they didn't want him to write his story because they didn't want to include it. But they let him insert that phrase, and it's been a marvelous stroke of fortune, probably even the grace of God, if you will, because it has opened the doors of this fellowship to persons of all religious beliefs, including the Irish Catholic alcoholic, without whom we could have our next international convention in a phone booth. But see, they would not have been fond of the Oxford groups because they were too distinctly Protestant and evangelical. And today we got Buddhists, humanists, atheists, agnostics, Jews, and Irish Catholics. And a bunch of people in between, and people who profess no higher power at all. I don't know how they make it, but they do. I think God allows some of us to stay sober just to confound the rest of you who think you know how you're doing it. See, I am on a philosophical basis still an agnostic. And I say that as a term of art, philosophically, and to make damn sure I'm never mistaken for Baptist. A good definition of the term agnostic is one that a friend of mine brought me in my Wednesday night step study, and it said person who says that the existence of God cannot be proven but does not deny the possibility of his existence. And I kind of liked that definition, and I went home and looked it up in my own somewhat cheaper dictionary of the English language, and it said, amongst other things, professing ignorance. I kind of like that, too. Now I know why I wear a bow tie. Because I am a professor. And I know what I profess. Ignorance. Makes it real easy. You know, I don't have to know much to teach ignorance. But I believe philosophically there is no absolute proof that God exists, and I believe that's probably because that's just the way God wants it. That requires an investment of self in the decision to believe. The third step says we're going to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I had to sort out all this. Well, what is my will and what is my life? And the ultimate simplicity of it is my will is what I want and my life is what I get. And so in effect, I've made a decision to turn what I want and what I get over to the care of some kind of a God. And if you define God on the most basic terms, if there is one, he must want a little reverence for himself as creator and our respect for what he made and our love for our fellow creatures. And so, you know, if I've made a decision to turn what I want and what I get over to the care of something big enough to be called God, then there are two implications of that decision, one personal and the other ethical. On the personal level, I ought to be satisfied. And on the ethical level, I ought to be loving. And so it seems to me that the implications of step three, regardless of your concept of a higher power, is whatever your circumstances are, be satisfied, and by the same token, whatever your circumstances are, be loving. Love being defined as, in my instance, as, with due credit to the Jesuits, being willing to wish well and do good towards self and others, and please note I didn't leave myself off of that list, because I think that's the foundation of the whole thing. After all, the man said, love your neighbor as yourself. And I'm telling you tonight that y'all are fortunate I did not take that advice before I got to this fellowship. Because there would have been a lot of people with the imprint of my foot square on their ass if I had loved them the way I loved me. You know. But I made this decision to be satisfied and to be loving, and I'm walking around and I'm still unhappy and I'm still unloving. And then I made a mistake. I asked somebody why, and they said, take inventory and find out. And this to me is the beginning of recovery. I know that you don't have people like this in Missouri, but in Texas we have what we sometimes call the AA waltz. And it goes 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You go back to a club, stay away from a club sometime for 6, 8, or 9 months. You gotta be at least 6 months to give it a fair trial, but you know, 6, 8, or 9 months, and go back there. You'll see the same people that were there 6 months ago, and they all had 6 months sobriety. And you ask them, how much sobriety you got? And it's still 6 months. You ask them what step they're on. It's always 3. And I found out when I made that decision and I didn't get the results that I thought were logically indicating, they said, I'm still unhappy, I'm still unloving, why? And they said, take inventory and find out. I found out that the way out of the AA waltz is to go from 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 in circles to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Fourth step suggested I look for 4 basic things: resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. And in order to do any kind of an inventory of those things, I had to have reasonable working definitions of them. I'll just share what I found out. For me, resentment is the feeling I have when I am remembering that I did not get my way at some time in the past. Fear is the feeling I have when I don't think I'm going to get my way at some time in the future. Selfishness is wanting my way right now, damn it. And dishonesty is fear of the truth, that maybe I won't get my way if the truth is told. So to do a fifth step with everybody in this room, the exact nature of my wrongs is that I want my way, and am willing to go to almost any length to get it. Well, down to being about that simple. And in step 6, it suggests that I had to be willing to have God remove these defects of character, and that suggests that I'm not capable of doing it myself. And it has been my experience that the harder I resolve to remove my own defects, the less adequately I am able to, and then the more I dislike myself because of my failure at changing me into what I think I ought to be, as a result of which the harder I try to change me into what I think I ought to be, and then the more I fail, and the less I like myself, so the harder I try. But that sets up a recurring syndrome of frustration and failure that's based on the attempt to remove my own defects, having defined them by my own neurotic standards in the first place. You know, and sometimes I'm trying to remove stuff that's not a defect and leaving stuff alone that is. And this is an unorthodox opinion of the sixth step, but I am persuaded that the best way to become entirely ready to have God remove a defect in character is to practice the hell out of it. Because see, you'll do it until you don't want to do it no more. And resolving not to do it will just make you want to do it. You know, what's the first thing you think of if I say don't think of the Statue of Liberty? Everybody's trying to not think of the Statue of Liberty, just had a mental image, you know. And step 7 said, I asked God to remove my defects of character. And there again, I'm glad that they used the word shortcoming. I understand that Bill was asked one time, what's the difference between a defect of character and a shortcoming? And he said, nothing, they're the same thing. His fourth grade teacher apparently had told him, you don't use the same word twice, that redundancy is not good style. And so, because Bill W. was the victim of a classical education, he wrote 2 different phrases in 2 different steps that are talking about what he thought were the same thing, but for my purposes, I believe there was a divine editor at work in evolving the big book in the text that it's presented in, because for me, again, there's a substantial difference between a defect of character and a shortcoming. Incidentally, I do like the use of the word defects because it reminds me that my defects are not my character. If you go down to your local Chevy dealer and buy your car and drive off the driveway and down the stoplight and the transmission falls out, and you go back and say, hey, the transmission just fell out at the corner of 1st and Main, they don't say, yeah, that's the way we make them. That's a defining characteristic and selling point of the Chevrolet automobile. No. They say, that's a defect. Yeah. They don't define products by their defects, they define products by their specifications. And then whatever doesn't meet the specs is a defect. But the difference, in my opinion, between a defect and a shortcoming is that a shortcoming is, in fact, a coming short. Whereas a defect is something that ain't the way it was supposed to be intended by the manufacturer. And so my shortcomings are the result of my defects, but neither one is part of my constitutional being. Neither one was inherited from the divine origin of my being, and neither one is a defining characteristic of who I am today. But shortcomings to me as a term of art implies that I'm going to have characteristics in behavior that are outgrowths of my defects of character, and that maybe I can have those removed without even having the defects removed. And I believe that's important because there is something in the 12 and 12. I hate to talk about the 12 and 12, and we're supposed to be on basis, you know. The 12 and 12 talks about instincts as being the basis of our defects of character. And even goes on to suggest that the reason the desire to drink is completely removed and these other defects are not is that these other defects are grounded in natural instincts, whereas the desire to drink is an acquired instinct. It's as if I grew a third arm and then had it amputated. I'd miss it, but not near as much as one of the original two. And I believe that my defects of character are outgrowths of being in the condition I'm in as a human being, and my shortcomings are the manifestations and action of those defects of character, and that if I had the instincts removed in the way that I once thought God was going to do it, and in the way I once thought God that I wanted God to do it, I have three natural instincts, and 12 and 12 says these are instincts for sex, security, and society. And if I had those instincts removed, I wouldn't be morally perfect. I'd be hungry, horny, and lonely. Step 7, I believe, is very specific about the shortcoming. I'm asking, in effect, I'm asking God to protect you from the behavioral manifestations of my defects of character. If I ask him to remove the shortcomings, then I'm asking him to help me to modify my behavior. And I'm not that different. If you ask a psychologist why they use white rats for all their experiments, there are three reasons. One is rats are cheap. Another is that they multiply quickly so you can observe several generations in a reasonable period of time. And the third is, if a rat will do it, you'll do it. And the other thing I absolutely and unqualifiedly know about rats is they don't bite unless they're hungry or cornered. So I have a policy towards rats. I try to keep them well fed and give them plenty of freedom. And my problem seems to be learning to treat myself like the rest of the rats. If I keep myself well fed, give me plenty of freedom, I'm not likely to bite. But when I put myself in a corner, watch out. I come out fighting. When I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I already had a past, and I didn't know how I was going to turn over the past, and you said, try 8 and 9. And step 8 suggested I make a list of the persons I'd harmed and to whom I'm willing to make amends. There are two kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, your kind and my kind. Your kind, go home and get a residential telephone directory of your hometown and check every name you recognize.
Yep, 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 yep.
And I, on the other hand, am a nice guy who never really hurt anybody. And somewhere between your 8-step list and my 8-step list lies the truth. And for me, a shorthand method of getting to the truth is the simplicity of putting down a list of who I'm afraid to run into. Because all of those people that I'm afraid to run into at the corner are walking away, there's a reason I fear to run into them, and in 80% of the cases, it's because I owe them something, some type of an amend. And in the other 20% of the cases, it may be that I don't owe them anything. It may be that there is legitimate victimization, and probably the popular example is the childhood abuse situation where the victim is afraid to run into the perpetrator, and that's not because the victim owes the perpetrator an amend. But there's a principle here. Steps 8 and 9 are not about them, they're about us. Steps 8 and 9 are not about them feeling better. They're about us having the freedom to go anywhere at any time as sober, self-respecting human beings. They're about my overcoming my inability to go anywhere at any time because there's somebody I'm afraid to run into. And so there might be somebody on your 8-step list who doesn't belong on your 9-step list, but the only way you're going to find that out is to put them on your 8-step list anyway. And what we're really talking about is if you're the one that can't go to Thanksgiving with your family of origin because you're afraid some other sucker is going to be there, yeah, he probably is. Whose freedom is being compromised? You know, if we're going to be sober, self-respecting human beings and free to go anywhere at any time, not fearing to run into anyone, we need to get the healing that's indicated in these relationships. And so I believe that everybody I'm afraid to run into belongs on that 8-step list, although not everybody on my 8-step list necessarily belongs on my 9-step list. The 9-step says we may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And my experience has been that we know most of our financial amends, and they're not difficult to list, they're not difficult to accomplish. And if you owe somebody $100, you either pay them $10 a week or $100, however you do it. How do you handle the ones that are more difficult? The indirect amends, the emotional amends, and especially the impossible amend like the amend of the dead. Just a couple of suggestions along these lines that work for me. As for the impossible amend, try to treat people in similar situations differently. If you pushed a wino out into a snowbank and you don't remember what state you were in, but you're pretty sure it was winter, the probability of being able to find that individual to make that amend is zero, but you might be able to haul a wino out of a snowbank if you get the opportunity. And as for amends to the dead, I believe you can pray for them. It's like chicken soup. It might not do any good, but it can't do any harm. And then I'm also an advocate of the unknown amend. And the unknown amend is based on the principle that nature always balances the books, but not always by the end of the month. And what that means to me is that when I go out into the parking lot and I have an immediate reaction of resentment and anger over somebody sideswiping my car, I remain a victim only until I remember that I used to have one of those rainbow bumpers that had every color of automotive paint available in North America on my right front bumper. And I still have no idea how many parked cars the universe owes me before we're even. And when something happens to me that seems unfair in which I seem the victim, it's always disturbingly similar to something I did to someone at some point along the way. And when I'm in those situations where I want to play the victim, sometimes I just need to be reminded of the unknown amend. We get down to step 10, we got to get down, got to get back to basics, and I got to tell you some things that are embarrassing. I don't really want to tell this, but I think I owe it to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it helps me to remind me, and then it gets me back to what have become for me a basics in this program. Long about 16 years sober, I had one of those emotionally disturbing driveway experiences, which is where you see your wife and your kids going out the driveway. You go back in the house and you think about it and you can't explain it to anybody's satisfaction, especially your own. And I got to this point in my recovery where I had not been doing a rigorous inventory on any kind of a regular basis. And I'd been going to meetings and I'd been making a sort of a cursory conscious contact with a higher power. But I'd been going to meetings just in case anybody needed my sage advice and experience. And the contact with a higher power was more ritual than anything else. And although I knew there were areas in my life where I was not managing well, I'd always been a faithful husband and a good father, and yet I went back in the house with my wife and my kids gone and had to recognize that the results I was getting in those areas of my life where I thought I was managing well were absolutely no better than the results I was getting in those areas of my life where I admitted I was managing poorly. And I didn't have the awareness to realize that, again, I had bought the proposition that I could wrest happiness and satisfaction from this life if only I managed well. So I made a rational decision, being 16 years sober and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I could not drink, and I resolved to kill myself. But I'd already got this non-refundable round-trip ticket to Tampa, because they thought they wanted what I had. So I made a decision not to kill myself until after the convention. I went to Tampa, and Charlie P. was doing his fourth-step workshop. And I went to Charlie's fourth-step workshop, and as a result of Charlie's fourth-step workshop, I got back to doing the tenth step. And when I got home from that conference in Tampa and resumed doing the tenth step on a daily basis, 30 days later, none of the circumstances but all of the feelings had changed to such an extent that I no longer wanted to drink and I no longer wanted to kill myself, and so I got back to doing a tenth step on a daily basis. But I got back to doing the tenth step exactly as it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we go back to those four significant defects of character that are talked about in the third step, which are resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. They're not in exactly that order, but that's the order I generally took them in. And I got back to doing the tenth step, and the miracle happened. The feelings evaporated. I again felt happy and useful and sober and hopeful and all that. But at the end of 6 months, if you'd have stopped me at the corner of Walk and Wait and said, "Doug, what kind of person are you?" I would have said, "Gee, I guess I'm resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest." You would have said, "Well, why do you say that?" "Well, that's what I tell myself every day. You know, sit down and do that tenth step. And today, was I resentful?" "Yeah." "Fearful?" "Yeah." "Selfish?" "Mm-hmm." "Dishonest?" "Yeah." "Well, what kind of person are you?" "Resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest." I discovered that they committed plagiarism on the Oxford groups in a backhanded sort of way. The Oxford groups had four principles that they called absolutes. And one of the things that we changed when we got away from the Oxford groups was the absolutes. One of the reasons, I believe, is that drunks don't do well with absolutes, especially when you talk about absolute purity. And most of us just, you know, you lost me on the first term. But they had absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And Bill, I think, had simply turned those around and taken the corresponding negative. It's not difficult to see that resentment is the opposite of love, that selfishness, almost by definition, is the opposite of unselfishness, that honesty is the opposite of dishonesty. The two that didn't seem to me to correspond were purity and fear, and that's because I had a limited definition of purity. The absolute purity, as the Oxford groups were suggesting it, would be mental discipline. No more, no different, no other than the willingness to dismiss the false, fearful, selfish, and dishonest thought as soon as it appears. And so on that basis, then, fear would be the corresponding opposite of purity. And I started doing a daily inventory of the four absolutes, or the corresponding virtues that go with those defects of character that the Big Book told me to continue to watch for. And so today I said, you know, was I honest, pure, unselfish, and loving? And as often as not, the answers are yes, 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 and yes. And even when they are not, two things begin to happen immediately by virtue of the process of taking the positive inventory. One is, I am defining my personality by those virtues and not by my shortcomings or defects. The other is, I begin to remove that shortcoming or recover from that shortcoming by the simple process of taking the positive inventory. And I can recognize those shortcomings for what they are, a shortcoming or falling short of a chosen idea. I'm not a defining characteristic of my personality. So if you ask me today what kind of person I am, I'll tell you that I'm honest, pure, unselfish, and loving, with shortcomings. But I'm no longer defining myself by the corresponding negatives. Useful definitions: honesty is telling the truth to yourself first and then to all others. Purity is mental discipline. Unselfishness is never wanting anything only for myself. And love is always wanting only good for self and others. And those, there may be 12 steps based on 6 principles, based on 4 absolutes, but of those there's only one fundamental, and that's love. Because I'm convinced it's because of love for self that I must be honest. I have to have the integrity to live in my own company. Because of love for God, I must be pure. Because of love for others, I must be unselfish. And so if there's one cornerstone of the 12 steps and the 4 absolutes, it's love. And if I can say today that I've been approximately loving in my thoughts and actions, then I've had a pretty good day. And I'm beginning to define myself by the virtue rather than by the corresponding negative. And if there's a point at which I dissent from the big book, I think that's where it is that our inventories ought not always to be taken in red ink. And in fact, I think that can have a negative effect on a person who's constitutionally disposed to think of himself as the turd in the punch bowl. There are only 2 attitudes which can defeat my sobriety. One is, it's not worth it, which is hopelessness, and the other is, I'm not worth it. And if I sell myself either of those 2 lies, I'll drink. And my disease is constantly running a campaign designed to sell me that it's not worth it, or that I'm not worth it, or both. In an ideal world, I'd believe both, and then I'd always have a reason to drink. It'd just be wonderful alcoholism. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. Talking to God. If prayer is talking to God, that's easy. We all talk to God all the time. I do anyway. Not always formally and respectfully, but I talk to God. And meditation is supposed to be listening to God. That's a little more different. When I listen to God, what I hear is not the voice of God. It's generally the voice of self-will. And it comes to me in melodious, divine-seeming suggestions that I can dress up in the proper language and present to you as God's will. I've discovered that the second tradition tells me that a loving God may speak to me through the group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, which usually means that if I'll simply go to a meeting willing to listen, there's going to be a wino in the room who's going to hit me right between the eyes with exactly what I need to hear. And that gives me a way of getting in 1 hour of meditation even on a bad day. You know, they say meditation is listening to God. I don't know about you, but I have days when I have had call waiting and I knew it was God. I would not answer. Because I'm pretty sure that I don't want to hear what I think he's going to say. And how do you listen to God on a day when if the phone was ringing and you knew it was God, you wouldn't answer the phone? You go to a meeting. You know, go down to the club intending to complain to somebody. You know, well, I'll find a friend and tell them what's going wrong. You know, go to a meeting willing to listen. It'll give you 1 hour of meditation even on a bad day. Because there is a loving God who will speak to us through the group conscience, whether we like it or not. If we just put ourselves in the atmosphere of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a higher power that will take care of the details. It's personal opinion. Step 12 suggests, and I'm glad they cleaned this up too, having had a spiritual awakening. We use the word awakening instead of experience. Again, personally, I thank the divine editor for that change. We tried to carry this message. The first thing said to others, especially alcoholics, now it's just 2 alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And to me, that wording is specific for a reason. One is, I had spiritual experiences, some drug-induced. None life-changing. But I had only one genuine awakening, which came as the result of these steps. And that is that I came to you people with a feeling of personal worthlessness and a track record to back it up. And you said, wait a minute, you're not worthless, you're sick. You gave me the disease concept of alcoholism and a spiritual program for recovery, which brought me to an awakening, which was an awakening in exactly the same sense when I open my eyes in the morning and see the ceiling. It is not as if the ceiling was not there while I was asleep. It's just that I've again opened my eyes to the reality of the ceiling. And I came to an awakening as a result of these steps. to a sense of self-worth as a human being and child of God, made in the divine image and not obliged to apologize to anybody for my own 2 square feet of space today. And it happens that for me the awakening and the message are one and the same, because the message that I can most effectively carry to the next drunk is simply to say, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. You're not worthless, you're sick. But for that there is a solution. And when I carry that message, it never fails to reinforce my sobriety, whether a drunk is capable of hearing it or not. But then I got into thinking, if this thing is really as good and genuine and pure and practical and spiritual as we think it is, why can't we share it with everybody? Why can't we share it with the world at large, especially alcoholics? And the answer for me is disarmingly simple. There's absolutely nothing original in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's absolutely nothing that I have learned here that they didn't try to teach me out there. In all fairness, I have to admit that my parents tried to teach me these principles. And my high school teachers and grade school teachers and Sunday school teachers and high school coaches and guidance counselors and even drunken fraternity brothers tried to teach me these principles. But I could not hear these things from them because I was convinced that they did not understand me. And in fact, we've been very generous with the 12 steps. There are literally hundreds of 12-step organizations. One of my favorites out in California is something called Addictive Organizations Anonymous. And Addictive Organizations Anonymous is for people who go to too many meetings. And I don't know, but I'm willing to bet that one of their slogans is, don't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. However that may be, we've been very generous in sharing the 12 steps apparently with every fellowship that needs them or wants them, and so why should we carry our message only to alcoholics? And the simplicity of it for me is this. I could have learned the 12 steps from a compulsive overeater. I could have learned the 12 steps from an Al-Anon. I could have learned the 12 steps just from paying attention when I was growing up. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the speaker at my first meeting had said, look, my problem was I had 16 donuts before breakfast. I would have said, you're right, that's your problem. And I would not have been able to identify with that person enough to listen to the rest of what they had to say. When I came to AA, I had to be able to identify with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on the basis of the problem. I heard people talk about wetting the bed, and I had to think, I did that. I heard people talk about sideswiping parked cars, and I had to think, I did that. Heard people talk about the brain tumor. Have you ever had a brain tumor? Mine, of course, was self-diagnosed, but I had all the symptoms. Excruciating headaches, short-term memory lapses, loss of equilibrium, slurred speech, tendency to slobber on myself, diagnosis, brain tumor. I'm here to report that when I stopped taking a case of Schwitz before retiring, God healed that brain tumor. It's a miracle. But when I could identify with Alcoholics Anonymous on the basis of the problem, I finally had the willingness and openness to hear from Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in my life a solution that's older than we are. And so the reason I believe that I'm called to carry my message to alcoholics is that only those who have the problem need the solution. And I believe that the traditions were designed to keep us honest to the simplicity of the proposition that we have a solution for people who have our problem. I believe that alcoholism for me, I should say my alcoholism, is a disease which is real easy to diagnose and for the same reason very difficult to treat. It's easy to diagnose because the primary symptom is drinking too much. And it's real difficult to treat because the primary symptom is drinking too much. And if we stop drinking too much, we can be in a condition of untreated alcoholism that won't even be diagnosed because we're not exhibiting the symptoms. But an ism, I believe, is a system of core beliefs which dictates all other thought and action. Now, examples would be communism, socialism, Methodism, Judaism, alcoholism. And one of my sponsors said, well, what about botulism? In Christian Science, anyway, botulism would be a core belief that an amoeba has eaten your ass for lunch. But I'm convinced that my thinking is oriented either in the ism of alcoholism or in the reference of recovery. The Big Book tells me about the daily meditation specifically that I should ask God to direct my thinking. And I believe that unless I ask God to direct my thinking, John Barleycorn will. Unless I'm in recovery, I'm going to be in my alcoholism. If I stay in my alcoholism long enough, I'll take the first drink soon enough. It just seems to be a principle that I have to remember to live by. And the reason I'm called to carry my message to alcoholics is that only those who have the problem need the solution. I'll go back to my driveway experience and let you know where I am today and how things are today. 16 years sober, my wife left. I wasn't getting the results in the areas where I thought I was managing well, but I expected to get from managing well. Nearly committed suicide. I knew I couldn't drink again, but I figured suicide was acceptable alternative to living sober. It's a pretty good definition of the disease, isn't it? Today, I'm in a relationship that had an inauspicious beginning if you listen just to the external description of the circumstance. Linda had about 13 months of sobriety. I had over 19 years. We dated for 1 month and got engaged. Sounds like a stinking 13th step deal, doesn't it? Of course, you know how we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Normal people take their intended to meet their mother. We take them to meet our sponsor. Our sponsors approved, so we tried our mothers. And our mothers cried. They thought it was wonderful. So we went to our daughters. I remember Linda's adult daughter, 23 at the time, when we told her we were getting married, she said, well, I'm not surprised. I've been hearing about you since I was 8 years old. And so in my mind's eye, I saw this adult woman telling me that she'd heard about me since she was 8 years old, and I saw my 8-year-old daughter, and then I looked back at the adult woman, and I thought, you know, that has been a long time. Linda and I had known each other for about 15 years at that point, and we'd been sort of circling each other, but neither one of us was available. And when the time came, it is as if a higher power had arranged the circumstances so that we would be put together in a situation where we could begin to build a relationship that's based on, I think, some principles that will make it work. The book is very specific about if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives and best friends to join us in our morning meditation. And in my first marriage, circumstances never warranted. There was no companionship on that level. Linda and I get up today and we start our day sharing that meditation and prayer, sharing that first few minutes of the day, sharing the experience of asking God to direct our thinking. Beginning to build a relationship on that basis, I'm finding that, I just loved it, Wayne this morning, beginning to build a relationship that I understand to be a loving relationship. Now, I'm only saying that because there is someone here who has just had or is about to have the driveway experience, and maybe not for the first time, and I know that you probably are resentful of the fact that there are those of us who have survived it, but that's not the point. The point is there is hope. There is hope. Now, to get back to basics for me is just this simple. If you're new in the program, make an unconditional commitment to your own sobriety. And that's all you have to do. Because I have come to believe that if you make an unconditional commitment to your own sobriety, you will do the steps. Sooner or later, willingly or unwillingly, the hard way or the easy way, but you'll do them. If you make an unconditional commitment to your own sobriety, you'll take the third step, either on your knees with a sponsor, using the form of prayer on page 63 of Alcoholics Anonymous, or on your back all alone looking at the ceiling and saying, okay. If you make an absolute commitment to your own sobriety, you'll take the fourth step, either willingly and according to the suggestions in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or under circumstances where other people present your defects to you in such glaring fashion that they can no longer be ignored. If you make an absolute commitment to your own sobriety, you'll take a fifth step, either willingly or unwillingly, because if you're not explaining it to a sponsor, you'll be explaining it to a lawyer. If you make an absolute commitment to your own sobriety, you'll take the ninth step either, you know, sooner or later, either by choice or you'll run into the bastards at the corner walking away. But I'm convinced that the only way you can avoid the process is to go back to drinking, and that the only way you're going to go back to drinking is to make an unqualified, or to make a qualified commitment to your own sobriety. And it's been my experience, I want to say this one more thing and shut up. It's been my experience that the higher power has a sense of humor. If I set any condition on my sobriety, if I'm going to stay sober unless or until, then that's the next thing that's fixing to happen. If I'm going to stay sober unless my wife leaves, she gone. If I'm going to stay sober until the dog dies, just got hit by a truck. It just seems like whatever condition I put on my sobriety is the very thing that's about to occur, so that God can look at me and say once again, you know, okay, sport, what's important to you? What is the basis of your sobriety? What is the quality of your commitment? What is the governing reality of your life? Is it a person, place, or thing, condition, circumstance, or an ideal? Or is it a higher power? Is it a creator who is indwelling and always present, always available? Are you willing to go the distance? I believe today that I'm the only human being who really has to spend the rest of my life in my own company. Everybody else has a choice. But since I have to go the distance, I'd like to be able to do so with some degree of self-esteem, some degree of self-love, some degree of personal integrity, with a few friends along the way, and the hope of successful relationships, satisfactory employment, all those things that everybody wants. And not just drunks want those things, everybody wants. The only way I know to ensure that that's at least possible is to go back to basics. And go back to basics on a daily basis. And go back to basics remembering that I am an alcoholic. And that my alcoholism is a condition I have to live with one day at a time, drunk or sober, for the rest of my life, knowing that I'm sober today by grace, and defining grace simply as the gift of a higher power. I'd like to close mentioning the second tradition. I already touched on it, talking about 11, but I close mentioning it again because it reminds me that it is because a loving God works through people like you that this hopeless, helpless alcoholic is sober tonight. And for that, I thank you.